more than any other creature, indeed far more than the flower in which Rabindranath Tagore invites us to see a letter from the beloved. The Father is a living gospel, bearing to his children the good news that God is a Father. Children of God. The Father transmits human life to his children. It also falls within his vocation to communicate supernatural life. I know fathers who experience a sentiment of sadness at this thought, when they hold a newborn child in their arms. Could this nostalgia be a confused memory of nobility that has been lost? As a matter of fact, theologians tell us that before original sin men would have had the privilege of transmitting grace with natural life. However the case may have been then, fathers must now accept their limits and lead their children to Christ through the person of the priest, to obtain the gift of grace that will make them, in all truth, sons of God. I spoke of sadness, but all sadness becomes joy when a father realizes that a new tie binds him to God. The baptized child is henceforward proof of the love of a father for God and the love of God for a father. A living gift of the Father to God, a living gift of God to the Father. As on the day of his birth, a father assumes a responsibility on the day of his child's baptism. He undertakes to cultivate this supernatural life which he has taken the initiative to ask of God for his child. Because the principle of this life is not in him, he must not for that reason neglect his active role in the spiritual growth of this young Christian. The sacrament of marriage, which gives him the graces necessary to live his love in a splendid manner, also confers upon him the help he needs to maintain, develop, and increase the life of God that has become rooted in the heart of the infant. And here, much more than in his other activities of an educator, he must be closely united to God the Father. He must be a supple instrument in his hands. He must practice the virtue of transparency. Christ, as the first educator of the children of God, will be his teacher. Let the Father meditate on these words, "I have come not to be served but to serve." Let him follow Christ's example, in the service of divine paternity in the souls of his children. Let him imitate Christ, leaving his apostles before any great decision and retiring into the solitude of the mountains to pray. Let him remember that there are graces which only prayer can obtain, that there are demons which can be cast out only by fasting. In this way a profound union will gradually be established between the Father and his Redeemer. Like Christ and with him he can say to the Father, "I have manifested thy name to the men whom thou hast given me out of the world. Father, keep them in thy name. I have prayed for them. And all my things are thine, and thine are mine. For them do I sanctify myself, that they also may be sanctified in truth." The Father will discover another mystery in his dialogue with Christ. If the seed does not fall into the ground and die, it will not bear fruit, but if it dies, it will bear much fruit. He will learn that there is something greater than giving life, and that is to give himself for those he loves. He will consent generously to the numerous sacrifices that are demanded of him. With Saint Paul he can then say, "I complete in my flesh what is wanting to the passion of Christ, for my children." And when the hour of death falls, the prayer of a father will again be the prayer of Christ, "I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from evil, that they may be one. And I have made known thy name to them and will make it known, that the love wherewith thou hast loved me may be in them." The Father in perspective. Let us conclude these remarks by contemplating the figure of the Father in its full perspective. This man who, at the invitation of God, decides to give life and conceives first of all in his soul the child who will issue from his flesh, who realizes clearly the splendor of the mission he is undertaking and promises to follow it faithfully to the end, who consents to all the gifts of love and all the renouncements that this vocation will demand of him, such a man truly merits the name of Father. Those who give life without reflection are not worthy of fatherhood, any more than are those who reluctantly accept an unwanted child, the involuntary consequence of the act of love. There is in every decent man a desire for responsibility. It can be detected in the most unassuming of men. But what responsibilities are comparable to those of paternity? Most others are small in comparison. They do not demand an unreserved gift of self. Paternity, on the other hand, involves the whole man and for all ways. It is not a burden that can be shrugged off along the wayside. The abdication of a father is no mere setting aside of a partial responsibility. It is a desertion. A father can never cease giving life to his child. He who does not accept these responsibilities is not a man. He who accepts them begrudgingly is little better than a mercenary. But he who accepts them and carries them with a full awareness of their import and with love is a veritable lord. There can be no greater nobility than fatherhood, because no love is more gratuitous, no gift is more definitive. Only he is fully a man who has received investiture of paternity. Who is not a father is frequently only an eternal adolescent, at the mercy of every tempting adventure. Only in paternity does the potential of every human faculty come into play and attain fulfillment. To be a father is to be an adult in the fullest sense of the word. It is to accede to the highest plane of activity which every man desires instinctively. In this capacity he is legislator, judge, master, defender, priest and king. Man is made for all of that. His family is the arena of his integrity and his competence. At the social level he can attain only partial fulfillment. On the other hand, his social action will be effective to the degree that he has exercised his manhood in the home. Again, we must not forget that the father does not work alone. At his side is a helpmate whose mission it is to share his life, whose highest duty and purest love help him resist the temptations that ever threatened to make him forget his duties as a father. A woman's masterpiece is a father. How can a man become a sovereign if her intelligence and patient love do not encourage him each day? How can he understand his children if she does not explain them to him? And how can children honor and love their father if she does not orientate their hearts towards him? But a father needs much more than human support to remain faithful to his vocation and to acquire that paternal perfection which his children are entitled to expect from him. He must be a man of prayer. His prayer must be that quiet in which a father communes with the Father, that heart-to-heart conversation where he meets his God in open trust, knowing by experience what a paternal heart is. In this kind of prayer, the Father will draw down those graces which he needs so much to understand in an ever greater way, through contemplating the love of God for his Son, what a father on earth must be for his children. Chapter VI. Life through love. The greatest joy a man and woman can know is, surely, to give life. God has shared with them the power of collaborating in the work of creation, of peopling heaven and earth. Few people ever deny the fact of this redoubtable and grandiose power. Many, however, ask themselves questions like these: should we use it with prodigality? Should it be exercised as often as possible under pain of shirking duty and not corresponding to divine generosity? Much could be said on this theme. We could, for example, construct a well-balanced theoretical debate. But souls are not hungry for theory. We are writing for Christians, and I think it can be taken for granted that none among us would like to be accused of cheating God. But there are practical problems to be considered here. To give life to children, to elevate them worthily, is always a heavy responsibility. It is to take on one's shoulders a grave burden that can never be laid down in this life. Can we commit ourselves indefinitely in this matter? What if our strength threatens to give out? Must we pay no attention to fatigue or to prudence, which would always be cowardly, or to reason, which would always be narrowly calculating? Or must exhaustion and sacrifice be accepted as an unbending law? Or would it not be wise, on the other hand, to strike a middle course and balance our responsibilities with our means, to neither presume on ourselves or on Providence? Most Christian couples are asking themselves, explicitly or not, these questions. Certainly fruitfulness is their honor and their nobility. But it cannot be denied that they suffer secret doubts and interior torments. There is no possibility of eluding the difficulty, of throwing off their obligations or even of procrastinating. One can live in peace only by taking sides. What man, however courageous and confident, has not had his hour of fear, or at least of apprehension, in seeing the cradles rapidly filling the nursery? What woman, a mother already overworked, has not trembled at the first sign of a new pregnancy? When these doubts and fears assail us, we can always ask advice. We need the counsel and enlightenment of others. But in such matters as these, no one can make our decisions for us. Basically, each home is an island that must answer for itself. I am, of course, not forgetting God, prayer and grace. But God leaves us free and we must use that liberty correctly. Can we ever be sure, even with the best of goodwill, of having chosen the right vocation? A certain doubt always lies buried in our conscience. We carry within us a disagreeable zone of discomfort and anxiety whence arises the sensitiveness each of us experiences as soon as this subject is touched upon. It is therefore with extreme charity that we must approach these inner struggles and painful dramas. And in this case, the most efficacious form of charity is not to parade principles, since principles must always be in accord with the variety of circumstances. We must try to understand the value of different attitudes, banish all traces of intransigence, crushing severity and lack of respect. Above all, we must invite souls to a clear understanding of the problem and to interior loyalty. We must help them to see clearly within themselves and to understand the apparently contradictory exigencies of Christian virtues, and finally, we must assure them that they are not deceived by mirages or fraudulent imitation. Inner peace is the reward of sincerity. Mystery of fruitfulness. A Christian who marries has made a choice among the different forms of perfect life. He has renounced the joys and responsibilities of celibacy and virginity to know other joys and responsibilities, and principally the intoxicating joy of calling forth new life. Human love finds its fulfillment in fruitfulness. No Christian man worthy of the name would dare deny it. The state performs its duty when it draws up statistics, when it becomes concerned over the low birth rate or care of the aged, or when it creates a social framework favorable to family life. All of this is certainly praiseworthy in its own right. But a Christian who transmits life, and transmits it generously, does not act after the manner of the state. He goes beyond this and looks higher. He follows a vocation. He participates joyfully and humbly in the mystery of being. To give life is to justify love, it is to safeguard love by multiplying it. It is still more, it is to accomplish a great act of religion. For a father and a mother, the most excellent thing in the world is this life they have chosen to perpetuate. In the presence of their newborn child, they dream of the grown man he will one day be. They see a soul called to be a saint. And since in them a tradition is continued and a line of descendants prolonged, they experience their solidarity with a rich past and a mysterious future. Only a mother and a father are really bound to other men, to the dead and the living, to generations past and future. They are joined to these by their children. They are closer to God, too, for from Him they have received a small parcel of creative power, and for Him they are preparing saints. We cannot even imagine the power and immense privilege of giving brothers to Christ. Parents are finally brought closer to one another, since the child is the measure and the bond of their love and prevents them from falling into the suffocating tendrils of egoism and pride. Fruitfulness crowns the mystery of love. It alone gives to marriage all of its moral, human and religious significance. It deepens their personalities. In certain cases it illuminates, for mystery only blinds those who turn away from it. But he that doth truth cometh to the light, John 3:21. Those who enter upon the path of submission to God's will are more easily capable of orientating themselves and of prefiguring the harmony of the universe.